From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and I'm Anmarai Roque, sitting in for Sandy Billings. And today, I'm bringing you a show about sustainability. How we relate to the Earth and how we can maintain this Earth is a big topic. Some see this Earth purely as a resource to further human advancement, while others worship its sacredness. Either way, in order to continue our existence, we have to sustain this Earth. Sustainability has been the buzzword everyone has been using in the last few years, from environmentalists to CEOs. In today's show, we'll bring you clips about sustainability that range from Obama's environmental policy to finding God in nature. This first clip comes from University of Idaho social psychologist Tracy Craig. She has appeared on Yin Radio a number of times, and we always talk about feminism and her college course, Psychology of Women, when she visits. This semester, however, she's teaching a new course, and she's seeing gender differences crop up in it, too.
This semester, I've actually been teaching a new course in environmental psychology, and it's been really interesting to see gender differences in that course in terms of how men and women respond very differently. So one of the assignments they were doing is to, I call them the elemental assignments. So they're supposed to go sort of get into a space where they're interacting with earth, wind, air, fire, and talk about what does that bring up for them, how do they see themselves in relation to that. And men seem to see themselves as much more agentic in that in the way that they relate to the elements, whereas women see it as something that's impacting them. And so
I don't know the word you used.
Elements?
No, agentic.
Oh, agentic, okay. Meaning that they see themselves as in control or having control over it. So when they see, for example, I had one student who wrote about sitting by a stream and seeing that stream as, oh, he could build a dam and irrigate a field next to it, and a woman sort of really, sitting by a body of water and talking about how it brought her peace and comfort and this sort of thing. So just a really different relationship. I haven't explored that in my research, but it's certainly been a way in which I see feminism entering into that course as well.
You just heard Tracy talk about rivers and how we relate to them. Water is one of the biggest environmental concerns, and Christy Swartz searched for insight about water in this next piece when she was only 7 years old.
Daddy, where does water come from? I must have been 7 years old when I asked him this question. He paused and looked up in the air, which meant his answer was going to take a long time to surface. My dad often takes long moments like this, which I found frustrating as a child. To avoid annoyment, I would focus my attention to other things, like owls hooting in the darkness and the cool air on my skin. We always seemed to talk more at night. After a moment, he sighed, looked at me and said, "The Earth." I stared back at him as if he was a ghost. Was that really his answer? This was really much more basic than I was expecting. "But how?" I asked. Looking back, I suppose I was expecting something similar to Aldo Leopold's poetic rendition of atom recycling in his essay Odyssey. After all, my dad knew everything. "The Earth makes it," he shrugged. I could have again asked, "How does it make it?" But I had been down this road with adults several times. I knew eventually the answer would be something like, "It just does," which in adult language translates as, "Give it up, kid. Forget it." This is something I was never very good at. I suppose I'm still not. I realize what frustrated me most about my dad's answer was the simplicity of it. When I left for college, my water question, and many more like it, still nagged at me. I majored in environmental science, where I was able to learn scientific explanations for natural phenomena. I learned about the water cycle and that the earth, skies, and seas reformat atoms into and out of water molecules on a daily basis. I learned that my dad's answer of the earth creating water was not quite accurate. It doesn't create water, because water has always existed, or at least the oxygen and hydrogen that make up water always have. I learned of theories and tools that attempted to explain the world, like the Big Bang, carbon dating, and evolution.
The clouds get heavy and the rain pours down. Precipitation.
Science has done a beautiful job in explaining complex situations through modeling and theory. What I learned most during my 4-year degree is that I ended with more questions than I started with. The answers I found in science left my soul with an empty feeling. The answers I found in religion left a bitter taste in my mouth and seemed desperately anthropocentric. My original water question hurled me down a spiritual, metaphysical quest that I have still yet to return from. Where does water come from? I recently realized I have been asking the wrong question for the last couple of decades. My question to my father was really not where does water come from, but why does it form? And in the same matter, why do we humans form? To be able to truly answer where water comes from, where this world comes from, we give a person an ability to answer life's deepest creation questions. What or who created this place? How did it get here? When did it happen? Perhaps it was a little unfair of me to expect my dad to have a thorough answer to the mystical nature of our world without advanced warning. Still, my 7-year-old brain is alive and always questioning, even today. Why do we exist? Why am I here? And a million other why questions that adults love to hear. So Dad, or anyone else that may have an answer, I would love to hear it. Even a simple answer would be a good place to start.
Water circles, water cycles, water dances, watch its spin. As the water coming to us goes around and round again.
When you are a reporter for one of the nation's leading newspapers, and your beat is a very specific political arena, you become an expert in that arena. You know the ins and outs, the history, and the players. So when Washington Post reporter Juliet Alpern talks about environmental policies of the new Obama administration, you're hearing an expert on that matter. Juliet Alpern visited Moscow, Idaho on March 9th, and in this next installment, she explains just how significantly different the Obama administration's environmental policy has been and is likely to be.
So what I want to do is give you a sense of kind of how much has changed in really, you know, a remarkably short period of time since Barack Obama has taken office, and both what this is going to mean going forward and also the challenges that the new president is going to face as he executes his environmental agenda. And I thought, you know, one thing that was interesting is I'm sure plenty of people watched his inauguration speech. I watched it with my husband in Union Station, close to the inauguration. And there was a moment where it was interesting where he said, for everywhere we look, there's work to be done. And then he starts listing things like building bridges and things like that. And he said, we will restore science to its rightful place. And interestingly, the crowd we were with, which was actually a very mixed crowd from very different backgrounds, there was a cheer that was let out. And I thought that was a really interesting commentary about particularly how people in Washington have felt about the role science has played in policymaking over the last several years. And certainly one of the biggest criticisms that, you know, that came up in the course of my beat covering the environment over the last few years, again since 2004, is how science had not guided environmental decision making, you know, under the previous administration. And so, you know, I think Obama sent a signal that was, you know, fairly clear that this was something that was going to change. And it's kind of exhausting covering the new administration because every day they literally are doing some sort of environmental related policy that I have to cover. And so, for example, even today, they came out with an announcement, the Environmental Protection Agency came out with an announcement saying that they're going to adopt a new policy towards the coal ash storage ponds that, you know, are around the country and that attracted a great deal of attention just a few months ago when there were these two spills in Tennessee. They said they're going to start and issue new regulations, but they've already said that they're going to do a nationwide inspection and an assessment of how coal ash, this byproduct of burning coal, is how it's stored and what kind of environmental threat it poses. And this is something where, again, for really literally a little over 8 years, there's been policymaking has been stalled on this issue. But, you know, that's just one of more than a dozen things that Obama has done on the environment since taking office in late January. So he announced that he's going to overhaul fuel economy standards nationwide. This was something that, again, the Bush administration had taken some steps to issue new standards in light of language that was put in the 2007 energy bill, but is something that at the very last minute the administration gave up on and said we're not going to deal with how to get tighter fuel efficiency standards. He's announced that EPA will reconsider whether to grant California a waiver so it can, for the first time, regulate greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. And this is something that California would do, but it has nationwide implications because more than a dozen other states have agreed to do whatever California does. And in fact, one of the big debates that's going on right now within the administration is whether they're going to let California set some sort of a stricter standard for cars and trucks, or whether, in fact, they're just going to come up with a universal regulation of greenhouse gases from vehicles, which is something that's never been done. They decided to not challenge a federal court ruling which declared the 2005 mercury rule illegal. This was a policy under Bush that was rejected by the courts. And in fact, once the administration announced that it would not challenge this ruling, the Supreme Court decided to let the lower court ruling stand. So it effectively ended up throwing out a 2005 rule, which was considered by certainly many people in the environmental and public health community a weak rule on mercury standards. They reversed, really overnight, the U.S. position on whether there should be an international treaty on mercury emissions worldwide, which these emissions are a neurotoxin that poses serious danger to, for example, newborns and young children in terms of their brain development. And they literally, the United States went to Nairobi a few weeks ago and said, we think we should start on an international treaty on mercury. And as a result of that change in position, Brazil and China and India said that they were comfortable with the idea of having such a treaty, and so that's moving forward. They adopted new appliance efficiency standards, which again had stalled for 8 years. They announced that there were 77 controversial oil and gas leases in Utah near environmentally sensitive land, which had been a hugely contested issue out in Utah, and basically the new Interior Secretary, Ken Salazar, said, we're going to withdraw. These were leases that had been auctioned off, actually, right at the end of the Bush administration, but had not been fully enacted because of a court fight. And they said, we're withdrawing those from development right now so that those leases will not be exploited. They retracted a EPA memo saying that carbon dioxide emissions are not a factor in whether a new coal-fired power plant could get a new pollution permit. They said that they're going to do a total review of offshore oil drilling policy. They announced just again a week ago that they're going to halt the promotion of commercial oil shale development, which is a big issue out west. Obama just last week said that he would force federal agencies to yet again get an independent scientific review on any actions they have that could affect an endangered or threatened species, and that they have indicated they're going to re-examine air pollution standards for the kind of small particles that can really contribute to lung and heart disease. And most significantly, they have both elevated the issue of climate change to a top diplomatic priority, as well as pledged to bring U.S. emissions to 1990 levels by 2020, with a very steep reduction, an 80% cut by mid-century. And one of the most amusing things is, again, I've been covering climate change for a long time, but our State Department reporter, for example, who's a very skilled, very experienced guy, has not been covering it because basically the Bush administration has not really wanted to talk about climate change, particularly in its kind of diplomatic meetings abroad. And one of the interesting things is I had been hearing that Hillary Clinton was going to make this an issue with her trip to China. And sure enough, she announced she was going to China, and she said that climate change was going to be one of the top issues that she discussed, along with the economic recovery and a few other issues, and international, you know, security. And my colleague, Glenn Kessler, came to me and he said, I've never heard a Secretary of State mention climate change before. You're going to have to brief me on this issue because I know nothing about it. And I think that just shows you how dramatically that's changed, that our lead diplomatic correspondent had no need to learn about global warming because it simply wasn't something that was discussed in these very important bilateral talks. And now suddenly this is something that comes up. I mean, Hillary Clinton brought this up in every country she visited when she was in Asia, and clearly has indicated that this is one of her top issues. And that's an incredibly long list for for just a less than, you know, 2 months. Now, granted, a lot of what they're doing is reversing some last-minute Bush administration rules, but again, some of these are very forward-looking and are kind of setting out the agenda for what's going to happen. Clearly, Obama in his, sorry, it's, you know, it's also, I'm getting used to saying President Obama. This is not something I've been saying for a long time. But so Obama in his address to Congress, you know, said he wants a bill that would cap carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, to come to his desk from Congress, you know, either this year or next. And so I think it gives you a sense of, you know, how they're really the kind of hitting the ground running on a lot of these issues. Now, if you look at who Obama has chosen to shape his environmental policy, that's another really clear indicator that he's going to move, again, extremely aggressively on a lot of these issues. You know, when a new president comes in, there's a range of people that they can choose, and certainly there was a lot of talk about how he was picking a lot of Clinton, former Clintonites, for his economic team and for different aspects of his team. But when you look at his environmental team, these are people who, again, have reputations, some of them controversial, but certainly for pushing the envelope on environmental policy. And so one of the, you know, best examples is Carol Browner, who under Clinton was the Environmental Protection Agency administrator and is now serving as the special assistant to the president for energy and climate change. And by creating this position in the White House, what he was doing is saying, you know, I'm going to put one person, particularly someone who's politically savvy and very connected, in charge of both shepherding my energy and climate initiatives domestically as well as helping oversee what happens overseas, because a lot of people are looking to the end of the year in December, it's basically December 7th through 20th, the negotiators will be meeting in Copenhagen to figure out if they can forge a new global warming climate international agreement. And this is a huge unanswered question of whether we're going to be able to do this. But I think it really shows the fact that he put Browner in that position and created something that didn't exist before is one signal that this is someone who's going to matter. And one of the interesting things is Obama has created a lot of czars, although granted some of these czars have fallen by the wayside. Initially, they were calling Carol Browner his climate czar. And one of my colleagues, Al Kamen, who writes a regular column and is very focused on all these appointments, he decided that he was sick of using the word czar, and he decided to call Carol Browner empress. And she actually called him up, and she was angry. And she said, you know, why are you changing my name to empress? Why am I not a czar like all the other czars, all the male czars? And he said, well, you've got to understand, because I guess before he'd been calling her czarina. So she said, why am I no longer czarina? And he said, but you have to understand, when you're czarina, that's like being first lady. It's only a position because of your husband. When you're empress, you're ruling the empire in your own right, so you should feel flattered. So the fact that she is empress, you know, in the Washington Post gives you a sense of some of her power. A few other folks that Obama has picked to help guide his policy is John Holdren is a Harvard University physicist who also served as a scientific advisor in the Clinton administration, but now has been selected as the top White House science advisor. And this is a 180-degree change from John Marburger III, who had been the top science advisor under Bush. Marburger was very tentative about any issue having to do with climate change. John Holdren is about as active on the issue of climate change as you can imagine. He is someone who's called for dramatic international and national action. When he was heading the American Association for the Advancement of Science, he pushed them to issue their first ever policy statement on climate change and say that this was a threat that demanded immediate action. And again, this is the person who will be interpreting the scientific evidence for the president, and you really couldn't find someone who is more eager to do something on greenhouse gas emissions than John Holdren. And then someone else who will be working with him who's a little less high profile, but she's also a Westerner from OSU, and so I feel she also deserves a shout out, is Jane Lubchenco. Some of you might be familiar with. She's a marine biologist, and she's been selected to head the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And she's someone who, again, has really described climate change as a huge issue that we have to confront. She has focused on everything having to do with climate change is affecting the oceans, what's happening with overfishing. She's, you know, both a very active environmental advocate, as well as someone who just consistently throughout her career has promoted the idea of scientists helping inform policy making and being active in policy making rather than being restricted to their ivory tower. So again, this is someone who will be taking office within a matter of weeks, who I think will be pushing very hard for change, again, particularly on ocean-related matters, but along with that, climate change. And then you have, and I think one of the kind of most active members of the administration we've seen so far is the current head of the EPA, Lisa Jackson, who came from New Jersey, where she headed the Department of Environmental Protection. One of the things she talks about is that she's actually from New Orleans originally, and her mother was a hurricane victim and survivor who was trapped in the Superdome and in fact lost her leg because she did not get the medical treatment that she needed in the aftermath of Katrina. During her confirmation hearing, Lisa Jackson has said, "I know the firsthand victims of environmental-related disasters, and this is something that I'm going to make as one of the hallmarks of my administration." And then on top of that, just to name a couple others, Nancy Sutley, who came from LA, is heading the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and then Steve Chu, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist from the Lawrence Livermore Lab out in Berkeley, is now the Energy Secretary. And again, this is someone who's written extensively about that. So on one level, you say, all right, he's got his green team, you know, he's already doing all these things. Is Obama going to rewrite all the rules on the environment? And there, the issue is certainly he's going to do a lot, but he faces tremendous obstacles. And I think that's one of the things that I will be covering and looking at in the months ahead. Getting a cap and trade bill through Congress is incredibly difficult. You know, it's really the lawmakers from the middle of the country who are going to decide whether a cap and trade bill goes through Congress. If you look at states, whether it's California, Vermont, Florida, these are all states that are far less dependent on coal for their electricity, far less dependent on, you know, far less oriented towards manufacturing. And so they, you know, in any of these issues, there really are winners or losers. And it's clear that states on the East and West are much more primed to benefit from, say, a cap on carbon emissions than states in the middle of the country. And so I think that one of the really tough issues that Obama will have to navigate, and all of these men and women who I've just mentioned, as they try to push for, you know, the first ever price on carbon, is the idea that you're talking about a huge transformation of the American economy. And while, you know, I've covered Congress for years, and you always are cutting deals, and, you know, we could see in the stimulus package, right, that if Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania was going to back it, they gave $10 billion to the National Institutes of Health because he's a cancer survivor and it's his passion and things like that. And, you know, these are deals that happen all the time. But when you're talking about something like climate change, you know, there's what the science tells you to do, and that's pretty straightforward. And then the question is, can you afford, as a policy matter, to roll that back a bit and to make exceptions and to make the kind of compromises that are an integral part of the legislative process when you know that that's actually going to undermine, in part, what your ultimate goal is of the legislation? I think that there are lots of different policy matters on which you can split the difference. And one of the toughest things about climate change is this is a very difficult area in which you can just split the difference and make people happy, because there's kind of what people are saying is necessary in order to avoid dangerous global warming. And either you do that or you don't. And while, of course, it's not totally precise, and I think this is one of the tough things that lawmakers have to struggle with, there's not perfect certainty. But still, you know, it's not quite as easy as buying someone off by giving $10 billion to the NIH, to say nothing of the fact that we just spent a lot of money. And, you know, there's a certain, you know, as much as Obama's happy to borrow, you know, on behalf of the federal government, I think there's also a limit to the kind of borrowing that one can do, which is traditionally what's used to grease the wheels of Congress. And so I think that that's going to be a tremendously difficult challenge. And there's a huge time pressure on there, because basically, if we don't have a clear idea of what we're willing to do in terms of the cuts in greenhouse gas emissions that are linked to climate change by early December, it would be incredibly difficult for our negotiators to go over to Copenhagen and reach an agreement with the rest of the world if we're still uncertain, you know, of what we're going to do. And one of the great mistakes of what happened in 1997 under Bill Clinton and most people, I don't know whether Clinton's quite admitted this, but certainly everyone else, including people who worked for Clinton, admit, is that the biggest mistake that he and Al Gore made is they signed an agreement which they knew wouldn't be ratified by the Senate, and there was just no political way that measure was going to make it through the Senate. And this time, people kind of know that they're playing for keeps. And as a result, the new administration has to be very careful that whatever it commits to overseas is something that can pass muster here at home. And I think that's a very difficult question. In other issues, like, for example, when you talk about the ocean, which is something I write about a lot, as Kenton mentioned, I'm working on a book on sharks, there, you know, we're really at a tipping point with a lot of really significant issues having to do with the oceans, but I think it's inevitable that that's going to take a backseat to climate and energy issues for the immediate future. And so again, you know, these are trade-offs. Like, I have a friend who always used to say life is full of choices. And one of the things I really like about covering the environment is I think it's all about hard choices. And I think that politicians and advocates spend their time trying to downplay the fact that these are difficult decisions. And I feel like one of my roles as a journalist is to make it very clear that there are real choices that we make, that they affect people's lives. And I think that we just need to be honest about those choices as we go about making policy decisions. And I'm not in the position of saying what those policy decisions should be, but it is my obligation to inform everyone who is a voter and is an American what's at stake. And so I think that that's going to be an area that's important. We're also talking about the fact that, you know, again, there are some really ambitious plans on the horizon, including restructuring the way that electricity is distributed nationwide. Like, it's all well and good to build a wind turbine in North Dakota, but they can produce plenty of wind energy, but the fact is it's really only going to be valuable if you can ship it somewhere where there are more people. And so that's one of the things we're going to be grappling with. And then one thing that I think it's interesting that Lisa Jackson has brought up recently is, again, as I kind of alluded to the issue of Katrina, she cares a great deal about environmental justice. This is kind of this issue of the idea that there are people in our society who have disproportionately suffered in the kind of system we have, the idea that chemical plants tend to be built near poor neighborhoods, and the same is often true of coal plants. I can assure you that when there's a push for an expansion of a coal plant right in suburban Virginia, where people are pretty well off and pretty well organized, they fight pretty hard to make sure that that doesn't happen. And this is something that really, you know, hasn't been on the table much. And part of this, and this is something that certainly some folks in the environmental community might get offended when I talk about, but the environmental movement in many ways has been an elite club for many years. And it's certainly, when you look at the people who head these organizations, almost all of them are white. They tend to be really super rich. Like, there's, you know, some of them, you know, are direct descendants of, say, founding members of our country. There's a reason why that's the case. And you know, that they've had the time to focus on these environmental issues. And so I think one of the real discussions that we're going to have in the next few years is over, is this a broad-based movement enough, and does it reflect the interests of all Americans? And so I think that's something that Lisa Jackson will really put on the table, and is something that might even make some of her fellow cabinet members feel a little uncomfortable with at times. When you look at the landscape, it's almost impossible to try to convey how dramatically things have shifted on this issue. I mean, I really feel like when you look at what Obama has done so far, there has been a bigger change on environmental policy than any other American policy. From a reporting perspective, it's an incredibly exciting time to obviously be chronicling how these decisions have been made.
Going away from politics, some people relate to nature in a different and more spiritual way. When Courtney Rush goes outside, she finds God. This is Courtney's story of God and the environment, her two greatest passions.
The bottom line is, the times that I've been in outdoor situations and been experiencing the outdoors, I always feel the presence of God there. And being outdoors, I think, draws me near to God. And so then, since both living for God and being outdoors were my passions, it was so neat that the two of them were so strong when coupled together. And I've just learned a lot about my belief in God and how his creation is not separate from him.
Courtney is an environmentalist. She studied natural resources and conservation biology in college. And when she finished her degree, she went to work for the Palouse Clearwater Environmental Institute. Court runs the volunteer program, and there couldn't be a better person to do the job. She's upbeat, energetic, passionate about her work, and able to talk to anyone with interest in their goals and abilities. Not a feigned interest, but a look you in the eye, slow down and pay attention because what you think matters kind of interest. And with that kind of interest, she can match anyone up with the right volunteer task. And if you're not sure that you want to volunteer, hang around Court for a while, and you'll discover her enthusiasm has rubbed off on you, too. As for her own personal interests, when she looked herself in the eye and paid attention, she saw that the environmental part of her was being met at work. But she wasn't seeing religious people contributing time and effort to environmental causes. So she decided to reach out to churches.
With my course of study in college, I was in restoration. I was in natural resources and conservation biology. And through being able to work at PCEI, it was almost like I got my network of people who were interested in that environmental sector. And most of our volunteers do not come from a faith-based mindset. Most of our volunteers come with environmental mindset first. That's why they're here. And I was noticing that not very many people of faith are in our community are reaching out for the environment. And I know they would want to if they knew about the opportunities, or at least if somebody told them, hey, have you ever thought about how important it is to be caring for our environment? And so with that, as I started thinking about that, then I set my goals for this year being to reach out to the church populations of the community and then also the elderly populations of the community, because both were groups that I wasn't seeing volunteer at PCEI. So with that, and with starting to have a goal of reaching out to the churches, that's when I started seeing the churches try to reach back and say, hey, we are interested in that, or that's a huge topic in the church right now. Come and tell us a little bit more about it.
Courtney may have hit on something big. Environmental conservation is a hot topic in Christian churches, she says.
It's actually almost a trendy hot topic in Christian faith right now.
Even so, not all Christians take the same stance as Courtney. The argument that she's heard is that it's God's will that global warming is happening. And if it weren't God's will, he could stop it and would stop it. If he can't stop it, he's not God. But Courtney doesn't buy it. Instead, it boils down to basics for her.
When Jesus is asked to sum up the Ten Commandments, you know, they're like, okay, basically, what are the rules that we have to follow? And he says, love God and love your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've really got to thinking about is how do we love God?
And that is done by taking care of the earth.
I feel like in protecting the outdoors, not only am I serving God, but I'm also serving the people that I love. And that would include my friends, my future family, you know, anybody that is involved in this world. I think that we all have a part in caring for it and leaving it to be a better place than we received it as.
She says that taking care of God's gift is an expression of love.
God gave us this amazing creation. And even if he said, this is for you to have dominion over, do whatever you want with it. It would be our choice to love him by caring for that gift. And I recognize that other people see it a different way. And I don't see how you could see it any other way.
And on this basis, Courtney has moved forward on her plans to reach out to faith-based groups. Not just Christians, but anyone who considers themselves spiritual, to encourage their participation in environmental activities. She first got invited to give a keynote talk at the Faith and Environment Network in Spokane.
It was really flattering because they wrote to PCEI and said, we'd need a keynote speaker, we're doing Faith and Environment Network, we're talking about why it's important to care for the environment as people of faith, all sorts of different kinds of faith coming together to this conference. Is there anyone that could be our keynote speaker? So it got forwarded to me, and I was like thinking about how do I audition for this, and do I need to turn in a resume? And so I wrote an email back and said, this is who I am, and I'd be really interested in it. And they wrote back and said, yeah, we know who you are. That's why we contacted PCEI. And of course, we want you to do it. So it was like they had already known who I was, and it was through an AmeriCorps connection. So an AmeriCorps member that had heard me just give a talk on volunteerism in McCall, her mom's on the network, and so I guess she had mentioned to her mom that I would be a good speaker for the event. So, cool. Yeah, it was totally cool. And then I spoke twice at Christian Life Center, which is CLC. It's a Christian church that is trying to get heavily involved with caring for the environment, and they were doing like a 6-week sermon series on the importance of taking care of our environment.
Courtney's presentation at the CLC was different from a keynote, more of a question and answer session about why the group should care about the environment. Or really, why Courtney cares, her personal story, coupled with an appeal to come out and help with the local stream cleanup on Earth Day. She has another talk scheduled this month in Spokane. She may have found her calling, something she was born to do.
It's something that I've been involved in for a long time. So since basically I was in high school, I've been taking trips with, say, my youth group. So I've been in the outdoors experiencing God with other people. Then my job through college was as a river guide in Colorado for a Christian rafting company, where I could either choose to or choose not to engage in conversation about God in the outdoors. And then, but I had the freedom to talk about with my customers about whatever I wanted. And then most recently in college, I started a group on campus, and it was called the Wilderness Crew. And it was an offshoot. I was involved with Campus Crusade for Christ. And so this was the Wilderness Off-Campus Crusade for Christ. And so I've been involved with getting other Christians and other people of faith into the outdoors to know it and to meet the outdoors, you know, and to see that it's worth protecting and that it's such a vital part of who we are. Yeah. And so through all of that, I've always wanted to become more active in talking to people and encouraging people to become involved in caring for our environment.
Courtney has found a way to combine her passions, God, and the environment. Her message is an echo of her experience, which is get out and get God.
Of course, we can't talk about the environment and nature without talking about animals. Last year at the Environmental Summit in Boise, Idaho, Sandy spoke with Terry Klug of the Northern Rockies Wolf Collaborative. The Northern Rocky Wolf Collaborative is a group of organizations, Defenders of Wildlife, the Sierra Club, the Wolf Recovery Foundation, and the Wolf Education Research Center, that share a common ideal. Here's how Terry Klug describes the group and what it's all about.
We feel that wolves are a very vital part of the landscape and should continue to be, and want to educate the public, let the public know what they can do to keep wolves in the landscape, and also to help educate the ranching community, the hunting community, to work together. There are ways to work together to protect livestock, therefore protecting wolves.
Is that a big challenge still?
It is a big challenge. Defenders of Wildlife has done a lot of work and continues to do a lot of proactive projects with the ranching community. And little by little, we're turning some of the ranchers around to try new things that are proactive, non-lethal measures.
Can you give me an example?
There is an ongoing project, but during the grazing season this year in the Wood River Valley up by Ketchum and Haley, a number of sheep ranching outfits, there is a wolf pack up there, and they graze their sheep through that area during the grazing season. And we had a project where we used to do a lot of different methods, such as fladry, which is hanging strips of red tape, so to speak, off of a fence to night corral the sheep, having field volunteers from the area that actually went up and stayed with the sheep bands at night, and if they heard noises would scare away the wolves. And during this grazing season, thousands of sheep went through that area, and we lost only one to wolf predation, which is wonderful.
Yeah, that's amazing. What's the red tape?
It's called fladry, and it can either be hung on an electric fence or on just regular wire, but it's hung a certain length apart, certain distance off the ground, and wolves don't cross it. Now, eventually, over years, they might get accustomed to it and change that behavior. But at this point, it's used to pen in sheep and lambs at night, and it has been a successful barrier.
That's interesting. Do you think the color is significant?
It may be the color. It may be that the way it sways in the wind, that sort of thing, but it has been effective along with other methods. Ragbots's remote activated guard are effective and used with collared wolves. And the way that works is when a wolf that is collared gets within a certain distance of the box, loud noises, sometimes light beacons, if that's part of the outfit, goes off and scares the wolf away.
Are a lot of wolves collared?
Not the majority, obviously, but in what the Fish and Wildlife Service and Fish and Game has tried to do, that in most of the packs, at least within the state of Idaho, to have at least a couple collared wolves be able to track where the pack is going.
How large is a pack?
A pack can be two, you know, male and female, or it can be, yeah, up to, you know, 10, 12. Most, I would say, are under 10. There are some big packs in the Yellowstone Park area, the Druid pack. I don't know the exact size at this point, but it's one of the more predominant packs in the park.
You start off, of course, by saying that we believe that it's valuable to have wolves in the area. Can you give me some examples, or at least one example, of what we've seen change that's a good thing?
But I think a real good example is what the gentleman showed yesterday, before and after in Yellowstone National Parks, in the riparian areas, with minus wolves, how a lot of that area was just grazed down to nothing. And then after the introduction of wolves, where the elk have moved to higher ground because of the wolf presence, and a lot of these, the willows, a lot of the plant material has grown back and allowed for a more balanced ecosystem in that area.
So if I recall, he was saying that the elk can't just hang out there anymore. They have to keep on the move.
Right, right.
And are the elk doing okay, though? I mean, sure, some are getting eaten by wolves, but, I mean, overall, are they doing okay with their moving around?
I believe so. I believe so. There's a lot of varying opinion on that, but we believe they are. And, in fact, the elk population was high enough that last year, yeah, there was an extra hunting, you know, in addition to the hunting season because of the elk numbers.
So there's enough to share with the wolves.
There's enough to share.
Yeah, very good. How long have the wolves been back in Idaho?
They were introduced, I believe, in 1995.
Yeah. And just a little over 10 years.
Yes. 13 years now, yeah.
How did you get involved in this? You're with the collaborative, which is the group of
right.
organizations. Is this
right.
a job or a volunteer role, or what's yours?
It started as a volunteer role, where I moved back here from South Florida, and where I worked with whales and dolphins, and obviously there are none in this area. So I got involved in the wolf movement and did a lot of volunteer work with Defenders of Wildlife over a period of years. And so now I'm a contract employee, so to speak, through Defenders, but for the Northern Rockies Wolf Collaborative as outreach contractor for the state of Idaho.
And what's your background that led you to this? I mean, obviously whales and dolphins, is it conservation biology kind of interest?
I'm not a scientist, but just the general interest. I've always been an animal lover, and working with whale rescue and dolphin rescue and realizing there are actually things that people can do that makes a difference, that can help. And then seeing the plight of the wolves and all of the misunderstanding and the emotional part of the issue, and realizing that, boy, education is such an important part in getting the word out that people can, there are things people can do and learn about to make an informed decision about things.
One other question is, you came back to the West or out to the West from Florida?
To the West.
So tell me about that little geographic excursion.
I've been around the country, I'll tell you. I was raised in Minnesota, and then my family moved out here when I started high school. And in 1988, I moved to South Florida, Miami Beach, for work, and spent 12 years down there, and then realized I missed the mountains and the people here so much. So I came back in 2001, I think it was. I work with worked for an insurance company in the claims areas. I ran a claims department down there, and then I moved into the systems technology area.
Yeah, so behind a desk until you're out.
That's right.
Helping the animals.
That's right. Yeah, I did that as a volunteer down there also, and just realized that it was just something I always thought, you know, if I could do this as a career, I would be perfectly happy. But doing it as a volunteer and supplementing what I did for a living just made it worthwhile as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At that same Idaho Environmental Summit, Peak Science Communications has a booth where they advertise their skills and drum up business. Sandy Billings caught up with Nicole Pearson, founder of the company, at their booth on the exhibit hall floor.
Well, I'm talking to Nicole Pearson. And she is with Peak Science Communications, and I believe she's the president.
I am, actually. My husband and I started the business. Well, I started it 2 years ago, and he joined about a month later when I realized that I didn't know how to pay myself or do my taxes. And I told him, if you don't want your kids visiting mommy in jail, you need to come in and help me out. So we've kind of teamed together, and for 2 years now, I've been growing the business.
Yeah. So. And what does Peak Science Communications do?
You know, we're a technical editing firm that specializes in the environmental and engineering industries. So there's a lot of technical editing firms out there who really focus in the computer world. And my love and interest, and my background is science, and so I wanted to really stay in that arena. So I decided to do technical editing and focus on the sciences, which is we really think there's a need out there.
So. And if your business has grown as much as I've heard it's grown, that demonstrates the need.
Yeah, actually, I started, like I said, 2 years ago. My husband and I took a spare bedroom in our home and converted it to an office with two desks, and we sat very close to each other. And 2 years ago, and we now have an office with 7 employees. So it's been really good. We've been really lucky.
And, and what kind of stuff do you edit? Is it technical or public relations or the gamut?
Actually, we really focus on the technical reports. We think we have a kind of an interesting approach to it. We call it our dual expertise approach. So half of our editors have science backgrounds, either environmental engineering or environmental science, biochemistry. And then half of our editors are English or technical communications backgrounds. And every report sees both people. Or I guess both people see every report. And we feel that the science people, they know what materials and methods should say and what the results should say and that they should match. And we know what scientific names are. And we really understand that science background. But we're not grammar experts. So that's where the English people come in. They catch our verb and noun agreements, their punctuation, all those little details. Like we always say that our substantive edit people, our science people, look at the forest, and our English people look at the trees. So we think we kind of cover the entire range that way. And so a lot of our reports are environmental impact statements, biological assessments. We do a lot of water and wastewater engineering reports, preliminary engineering reports, facility plans. We've worked on everything from bighorn sheep to bliss rapid snail. So, you name it.
So it sounds like you get to indulge your varied interests as well.
We actually really do. It's funny because Erica Jensen, one of our employees, she says that it's like being in grad school every day. So she has her master's actually, and she loves it because she gets to read about something new almost every day. So. It's fun. We learn a lot. We learn a lot, and we become involved in what's going on. You know, we go to public meetings to hear about what's happening with the bighorn sheep after we've read the reports, and so it's fun to be involved in the community, too.
Yeah, you become mini experts in all of these fields.
We do. We do, and we know more about aquatic snails than anybody would ever want to know.
Well, obviously somebody does. They wanted to report on it. How did you make that leap? What made you say, I'm going to do this at my home?
You know, I've always wanted to own my own business. I think you have to want that. And I would have done anything eventually. You know, I just would have kept going until I found something that was a good niche for me to own my own business. My husband's kind of the opposite side. He really didn't want to do that. He was in the mortgage industry, and sort of circumstances were that his job was actually riskier than joining the business. And in fact, his office did shut down 3 months after he left. So we just kind of learned through history, different jobs we've had, that there is no job security. You know, at least if our business was going to go out of business, we were going to know about it before it happened. So I've always wanted to, and I guess I also, you know, I've had a lot of different kinds of jobs and worked in different places with different people, and I've had some really bad job experiences, and we really wanted to create a working place where people love to be there. You know, we call our employees our colleagues. You know, I introduce them as my colleagues because, you know, they're what make us work. They're so important to us, and I think employees aren't often treated that way by employers, and I've been treated by different employers, and so we, you know, part of it was we really wanted to create a great place for people to work and people with science backgrounds to work in Idaho, because when we moved back, we're from Idaho, northern Idaho, and we moved to California for 5 years and came back home to be near family, and part of it was we couldn't even... we couldn't find a job. It was hard for me to find a job in my industry. There were few state jobs. It was, you know, I'm in biotech. There was nothing. And so a lot of people have to leave here in order to find employment. And so that's also why we tend to hire science people. Is we say, hey, you know, here's a place you can work where we're really family friendly. Nobody misses a school performance. Everybody volunteers at their school. We make sure that they go, that they get the time to do that, because we hire a lot of working mothers, and there's not a good place for them to be. If they have a science background and they're biologists, they're expected to go on the field for 2 weeks at a time and live down at Hell's Canyon, and a lot of people just can't do that. So it's kind of a passion not only for what I like to do, but wanting to have a business where other people do what they like to do and have a good place to do it, I guess. So
I hope that that's a growing trend.
I hope so too. And I know I've heard with the economy slowing down that things like flexible work hours and all those little perks that people are the first to go. And it's really sad because that's what we can keep our employees. I think we pay them as well as we can, but the reason they really stay is because we understand that this is their job, and we hope they love their job, but we know that they love their life more, and we know that, and so we make sure that they're there to meet their kids at the end of the day getting off the bus, and they don't have to worry about who's meeting them, who's picking them up, who's dropping them off, you know, is daycare going to pick them up and remember them, and so, you know, we kind of do what we can, and
that's great.
Yeah, and they seem to be happy with it, so it's supposed to work for us, so.
Thanks for spending time with me. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks.
I'll leave you with this song called The Beginning of the End by Rust. Listen to past shows or podcast the show or sign up for electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfoundation.org. That is yinradio@v.p.found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and heard on Boise Community Radio at radioboise.org. And on other stations around the country. This show was produced by Anne-Marie Roque and Sandy Billings. Music is by Piano Chocolate and Rust. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Sandy Billings is executive producer, and I'm Anne-Marie Roque. Thank you for joining me.